Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to the 140th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode was brought to you by patrons Artemis and Alex Griboskis. Thanks, guys. I'm Matt Enloe.
And I'm Oren Kaplan, and today we have Michael Pressman on the podcast. He, I think, probably has the most credits out of any of our guests we've ever had.
He's up there, that's for sure. He's directed a ton of movies, a ton of TV movies, and a ton of TV.
Yeah, he directed Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, Secret of the Ooze.
Secret of the Ooze.
He's done like 25 episodes of Law and Order. He's done Weeds. He's done Justified. He's done Elementary. He also directs plays. He even did a $200,000 film in the middle of all this.
That he stars in.
Yeah, I mean, for a person that has like such a pedigree and so many TV credits and worked on so many things, he is still not afraid to go take an acting class and make a no-budget movie. And to me, it was really inspiring because a lot of times I think of this business as a business for the young people. Like, you make your Fruitvale Station at a film school, and then you do your Rocky, and then you do your Black Panther. And if you're not that, then you failed. But like, talking to someone like Michael Pressman, it's really inspiring in terms of just like the longevity of a directing career.
He has restarted his career multiple times and come through on the other side a total and complete success. And he's still in love with the art, still passionate about filmmaking, and is a total inspiration. So if you're curious about TV movies, TV, or movies, Michael Pressman has multiple nuggets that you are going to love. And also, he's going to play in Venice right now, playing called Finks. Great. It's based off of some true life stories of McCarthyism, and he is the son of a blacklisted director and screenwriter, so he's got a really personal take on this play as well. Finks is playing through the end of December. If you are in Los Angeles, you should go check it out and learn all of these awesome tidbits from Michael.
Before we get into our conversation with Michael, I want to remind everyone we have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/justshootitpod. It's a way, if you want to support us, it's helpful. You'll get a monthly newsletter. You will be able to come to our live events a little bit earlier. But most importantly, you'll help us pay our editors and just help us keep the podcast going. Check it out, patreon.com/justshootitpod. We appreciate anything you want to contribute. But if you don't want to contribute, we appreciate you nonetheless.
By the time this episode drops, we hope we'll have recorded what I assume is going to be just a incredible, life-changing, earth-shattering live show. Best friendships will form. Certainly someone's going to find their future life partner there. Tons of movie deals are going to happen, all thanks to your support.
Yeah, I love it. And with that, let's talk to Michael Pressman. We are on with Michael Pressman in New York, right?
Chicago, but that's close.
Oh, Chicago.
Yeah, it's cold here. I just got here.
It
took me a day to get here and start prepping on Chicago Med, which is the episode I'm doing here.
So you direct a lot of Dick Wolf shows, right? You're doing Chicago
Med. At
the
moment, I do, yeah, yeah. They say it's the organization that hires, Jewish males over 60. So I still seem to be in demand, but I'm mocking myself. I do good work. And I moved to New York from Los Angeles about 15 years ago and was immediately called to do Law and Order, which I did about eight or nine episodes. And then I've done 14 of Law and Order SVU. So you'd say I've been doing a lot of work for the Dick Wolf Company.
You know, it's so funny. That's part of the reason why Oren and I started this podcast is because directors rarely get to talk to one another. You know, like there's only one of us typically.
I had an interesting experience, which is when I started in television series, I had first started in feature films and did, you know, six feature films in a row in my late 20s, early 30s, in the 80s, like the sequel to the Bad News Bears, Bad News Bears American Training, and Dr. Detroit, and the Richard Pryor movie, Some Kind of Hero, and then some other really interesting films that did no box office, but were considered cult favorites, and then got into television movies, and then got into series television in the 90s, where I met David Kelley. And
Wait. We can't skip Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
No, we can't. Wait. I skipped Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Secret of the Ooze. I can't believe I did that.
I just Michael, jumped I saw right opening by weekend.
Year of my life. Oh, okay, man. You're one of the many. You're one of the many. This is my life.
Right.
I live with it. It's not a curse. It's a wonderful blessing because the film was so much fun to make. It was one of the high points of my life in the sense that it was sheer lunacy is the best way to put it. I thought I was making an extended Marx Brothers film. And yet I was learning about, you know, puppets and creatures, the Henson Company, and it was just thrilling. It was thrilling, and it came about on a total fluke. And I was literally talking to someone today about how I got that job because I was directed. It's such an interesting story. I was sitting today in the office in Chicago here on Chicago Med, and this young woman who I just met who's observing me said, "You made a movie that changed my life called Joshua's Heart, this television movie starring this boy Matthew who was amazing." And I said, "Oh my God." I said, "So rarely do I hear about TV movies." I said, "But what was interesting is that when I did that television movie, Matthew Lawrence, who was I think 10, was talking nonstop about the Ninja Turtles. And I had gotten a phone call about would I meet on the sequel because I had success with the Bad News Bears in Breaking Training. And I knew nothing about it. And I turned to Matthew and I said, what do you think if I went and did the second Ninja Turtles?" And he just went nuts. He said, "Oh my God, Mike, you got to do it. You got to do it. You got to do it." So I went to the theater that weekend and I watched the first one and was a little, didn't quite know what the second one was about or could do. And I met them and my thoughts and the thoughts of the producers were in the same line, which is to lighten the film, make it more comedic, and just have a much more fun, brighter experience. And it just happened overnight. And all of a sudden, I was jumping into that movie, which has changed many
people's
lives.
That's awesome.
The 25th anniversary of the movie, there was a special screening at a festival in New York last year, and I went at midnight to this audience, and they all said, "You know, did you ever think you'd be here 25 years later?" I said, "Not in a million years." I said, "Who would have known?" But I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled you all want to come back and re-experience it.
Sure. But to be fair, you must have known the Turtles were a phenomenon, you know.
Like, did you have any, I apologize if this is too personal a question, but did you have any kids at the time that you worked on that movie?
Well, no. I hadn't had job, but I have to tell you another experience to give you an idea of where my head was at. It was at the time when sequels were not the most popular thing in the world, and there were sequels that were coming out and they were dying. And I remember vividly the opening weekend of that movie. I'm driving in Los Angeles and I'm listening to the radio. It's like 12 noon or 2 p.m. and I hear an interview with a little boy at a movie theater, and the little boy and the interviewer saying, "We're here at opening day of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, and I'm here with little Johnny, who skipped school. What do you think, Johnny? And he goes, oh, I can't wait to see it. And by the looks of things, it looks like just little old Johnny and his mom are here, so the other kids decided not to come. And I freaked out. And I pulled over on the side of the road, and I got to a payphone, and I called the head distributor of New Line Cinema, and I got him on the phone, Mitch somebody, and I went, I just heard on the radio that the two people at the theater, what's going on? And he said, wow, we're not doing anything at that movie theater. Things opening big all over the country. You got nothing to worry about. Relax. And I got off the phone, and I burst into tears. And I burst into tears because I said, is the future of my career in the hands of 10-year-olds, is it what they decide? That because this business is so cruel. Well, thank God you all went. Thank God you all went. So I had no idea. You know, you can open a film and no one shows up. Or you can open a film and they're lying sure. around the block. And I'm telling you, it's happened to the best of them. It's happened to the best of them. You think with Steven Spielberg's failures, he knew they were coming? He didn't mm-hmm. know. They've been there.
Right.
You know, my God, I remember when I was doing, I think it was Dr. Detroit in 1941 came out. It was like, you know, they just turned away from it. You know, these things happen.
Right, of course. Yeah, so Dr. Detroit is a
Dr. Detroit was not a was that right. Dr. Detroit was, and I don't know what your perception is, but that film was not a commercially successful movie. In fact, we were not commercially successful or critically successful. The critics really didn't like it, and the picture closed in several weeks, and then it developed this incredible underground following over the years. But that film set me into directed jail for 2 years.
You know, that's interesting to talk about.
I mean, I don't know if you're aware of that.
No, I wasn't.
Anything about it.
Yeah, because I think that people reference Director Jail all the time, right? But I think it's interesting to talk about, like, as a person who's come through and out the other side. So Dr. Detroit doesn't do well. You know, you've had a handful of movies. Things are, you know, were going great for you. And you said it took you 2 years before you booked your next job. Tell us about what you were doing in between that time.
Well, that's very interesting. Well, first of all, I remember I had gone back-to-back movies. I had done the Richard Pryor movie, Some Kind of Hero, and then I was prepping Dr. Troy. So 2.5 years of nonstop work at the age of 30 and 31, which is pretty wild. I look back and I can't believe it.
Yeah.
Okay, I was in a rarefied world. And I was burned out. And the opening weekend is a big screening of Dr. Detroit in Loyola College in Los Angeles. 1,000 kids in college go to a screening. And it's like unbelievable screening. And I get on stage with a guy named Gary Probola, who was, you know, showing films on the opening weekend. And he looks at me before we start the interview and he said, congratulations, you finally got a big blockbuster. And I said, the film is not opened well. And he went, what? I said, no, it didn't open well. It's going to be pulled in a couple of weeks. He was like in shock. And this whole interview was like in front of this audience. He couldn't believe it. What did I do? Went into a pretty serious depression, but I was feeling at the same time like I wanted to live my life. I took my first trip to Europe. I went to England and France. I came back. I called my agent. And that's when he sort of said to me, well, you've been gone for 2 months. There are no jobs. There are no offers. And, you know, we're going to try to get stuff, but it doesn't look good. And I took a real kind of fuck you attitude. And I started writing a screenplay. And I started directing theater. And I had the time of my life. And I directed the play version of Tigillion on our 37th birthday. Which is another crazy story because 10 years later, I got to direct the movie of that play. And I was making no money, which was fine by me. I was actually going through a divorce. And my life was a total mess. And I just, and I will honestly say, you know, I was doing drugs because I was out of my mind. And then finally, I was down to my last $4,000. And I had a business manager who, you know, straight out of like the movie A New Leaf, if you remember that famous film by Elaine May with Walter Matthau driving a car, crying, saying, I'm broke, I'm broke. And Anyway, he took me to a bank and he got me a line of credit and he said, you need this $50,000 to last the next 3 months because you haven't worked in 2 years. And I went, really? Oh my God. And I called my agents and I said, get me anything. And they got me a television movie. And then they got me another television movie. And I proceeded to do 3 television movies a year for like 5 years. At which point I said, I went back to directing school. I got a chance to direct all 25 movies for television. Okay. And
Michael, is this like life? This is pre-Lifetime, right? It's like ABC. Is it like after-school specials or nighttime?
No, they're nighttime stuff? NBC, CBS, ABC movies. It was movies.
Dramas.
Yeah. Movies of the week. Saturday night at the movies. Sunday night at the movies. Wednesday night at the movies. That's what the networks had. Every network had 2 nights. Each network was making 100 television movies a year. If I wanted to do 4 or 5, I could do them. I was making 3 a year. And I would work for 3.5 months. Then I'd take a break and I'd do another.
Were you trying to make them like awesome? Like, I know it's a dumb question, but like,
yes, I was.
Were you pouring your heart and soul into each one of them?
Yes, I always was. And I do that with the episodes too. And then finally what happened was after I'd say 7 or 8 or 10, the quality rose and all of a sudden I was doing an incredible television movie starring Angela Lansbury about a flight 007 that was shot over Russian airspace. And then I did a television movie called To Heal a Nation about the building of the Vietnam Memorial starring Eric Roberts. And I was starting to do the quality television movies. And then I got a Hallmark Hall of Fame, which was already now into big budgets. You know, these were like $4 to $6 million movies. And I was starred Tom McCarthy, who's a dear friend who went on to direct and write Spotlight, and he was an actor, and he starred in the movie, and it was written by Ann Tyler, who's a brilliant novelist, and this was called Saint Maybe. So all of a sudden, I had this whole new career, and it was never what I intended. So I was a very reluctant success in television. Mm-hmm.
And are you making, like, do you get paid residuals when these movies air? Like, how, like, are you...
Yes. Yes.
Becoming very wealthy during like through this TV movie process?
No. You want the dirty details? Let's see. I was making
I mean, you don't have to tell us exactly, but I think a lot of I did one TV movie and a lot of our listeners I think are maybe looking at that as like a gateway into like you said, A, becoming better directors, B, like having a, what I love about TV movies is there's this like real clear deadline, right? This movie is going to air in 3 months. So you can't edit it for 2 years.
Right. You can't. You've got 3 weeks and you've got 18 days to shoot it. And you've got, you know, it doesn't matter if it's an intimate drama or it's a period piece, it's 18 days. And I did, Revenge of Al Capone, the period film. And I was really having a great time, and then it started to wear on me because I started to feel like I was not having the opportunity to make the kinds of films I made when I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I'm now in my late 30s.
And Michael, were you still returning to theater from now and then, or were you purely just cranking?
I did another 2 different plays in Los Angeles. I went back to an acting class and I started acting and writing. I had written several screenplays and wasn't able to get them made. So I was doing a lot of different things. But this was my bread and butter so that I could direct and not only make a living, I could pay off debts.
And you're also becoming a better director, I assume, on every...
Much better.
It's not like you're a comedy guy or an action guy or a drama guy. You've done everything.
Pretty much. I think that I love comedy. Comedy is very hard, but... you know, the irony was that now that I remember we're talking about this and it's coming to me, at the end of my TV movie run was when I did the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2. What happened, strangely enough, was nothing really career-wise changed out of Ninja Turtles, because people who thought it was a terrific, fun movie didn't think of me for anything else, because it was sort of like a, you know, Hollywood didn't know how to deal with it. Studios didn't know how to deal with it. It was such a, you know, a uniquely different kind of thing.
Sure.
And
it's both easy under to estimate because it's a kid's movie, right?
Right.
And then also it's a sequel. So
right.
It's like, no matter how awesome you did, it's like, well, of course, the first one did great, so the second one did great.
Exactly.
Even though, you know, it's a different movie, you elevated it, you did something different, you know, people are just kind of dismissive of it.
Well,
and at the
time that
movie came out, was it like, it was before like superhero movies were the biggest movies in Hollywood, right?
Correct. This was an offshoot. This was New Line Cinema. It was not what it is today. It was, you know, sadly, it's ahead of its time, because now to do a, you know, an action hero film for $100 million budget would be a very cool thing to do. You know, it's pretty
right.
much.
Right. You got Michael Bay did the last one, right?
Right.
The last
right.
Ninja Turtles,
which I didn't see,
yeah.
So I can't judge. I don't know. You know, so what happened specifically was, after Ninja Turtles opened and it was this big hit, and there was a lot of press about it, I think I was naive again. I think I have a naivete. I was thinking, well, something's going to happen. And it really, I had to do it. And I didn't have any, the other thing too is that the escalated post was so fast on Ninja Turtles that I finished shooting in January and it came out in March. So,
whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
I had two editors. They're working while we're shooting. I'm looking at cuts. We just sped the whole thing up, and I was exhausted, and I wasn't like, now I'm energized to do my next thing. And, you know, time went by, and then, interestingly enough, I got a phone call to meet David Kelly for the Picket Fences pilot.
Wow.
And it was recommended by somebody that I had worked with and through connections. And I met him. We got along great. And he didn't hire me. So I didn't do the pilot. And I was really disappointed. I loved the script. And I thought it was like a really special situation. And so I went off and did another television movie. I got one and hadn't worked since 4 or 5 months and said, okay. And while I'm shooting that TV movie, the phone rings. It's David Kelly. And he says, well, the pilot's sold, but I need a co-exec producer to be a producer-director on a series. Would you be interested? And I said, you know, I could pretend and sort of string this along, but I'm going to answer yes now. I said, I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to dick around. I said, absolutely.
And you had never directed an episode
never.
Of episodic
never done,
TV.
Before. I had never done an episode, period, yeah. So I came,
and David Kelly wasn't David Kelly yet, right?
No,
this
he was
before
not. He was
Ally McBeal.
He
and everything
was
else.
On the rise. He had won Emmys for L.A. Law. I had watched a little bit of L.A. Law. I thought his work was terrific. I could tell he was the next up and coming, talented writer, you know, producer. But once I read the script of Picket Fences, I felt like, you know, and I remember telling my wife at the time, my second wife, I'm going to do this. I said, it's going to be 13 episodes and out. I mean, the show is not going to succeed. This show is too different. It's too quirky. I knew nothing. And who knew? The show went on to win 16 Emmys in 4 years.
Wow.
And it won Best Series for 2 years in a row, Best Actor and Actress. And we were getting on the stage accepting Emmys. In fact, David Kelly said to me for the second season, when we were nominated, and he was really convinced. I mean, he was very sweet, but I had a feeling he somewhere knew, or thought he knew, that we were not going to win and that NYPD Blue was going to win. So he said, you know, if they call out and Picket Fences, you can accept it for the best show. And I said, really? So I prepared my little speech, and it was supposed to be NYPD Blue, and we won. we won the second year, and we were all just completely shocked. So that was an incredible ride of not knowing where any of this was going.
You already had your depression after your first movie, and then right. your kind of slowdown after Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2.
Right.
And so I guess kind of like a learning thing from your career is like you kind of had these like various runs and stages, and there was never a point where you like gave up directing and said, I'm going to go, be work in development at a studio.
No, I never give up. I will say that I have a survival instinct. It was real highs and real lows. In terms of someone from outside, I've had an incredible career. From the inside, I never made that $100 million personal movie that, put me on the zeitgeist of the culture. But that's in the dreamland. I'm now 68. I've got another good 15 years of directing, or 20, depending on how far I go. And I have some very specific goals and dreams of going back and making probably really personal, small movies, or anywhere from 200,000 to 2 million, and just make my own work and try to raise the money to do independent small movies and theater. And
yeah, well, what's so fascinating about that, Michael, is that I'm sure all of our listeners are connecting with you right now, because everyone's got some sort of, day job, whether it's directing commercials or, stuff that's not their passion project, basically, or literally a day job,
yeah.
They could be an accountant somewhere.
Right.
And it's so fascinating to look at your IMDb to see how many highs and lows and different chapters of your career, you've got, 3 or 4 lifetimes worth of work under your belt, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to hear you say, what I really want to do is my personal $200 million or $200,000 movie.
Right.
Like that, we're all, like every listener is like shouting at their car radio right now saying, me too.
I know.
It's so incredible to think that.
Well, what's happened.
That's always where we are,
It is where we are, because what's happened is it's really become an art form, purely an art form. It's like what happened to the photograph, where it was no longer in the hands of Matthew Brady and another, 5 or 6 brilliant photographers, and cameras could be handed in digital form to anybody. And now many people, the cream will rise to the top, and everyone can take photographs and work on their Lightroom and make prints and do incredible stuff. And now we've taken the cameras out of the studios that used to be, you couldn't shoot a 35mm film. Now it doesn't exist. You can do 4K on your iPhone. I mean, it's incredible. And, I did that, by the way, very early, 12 years ago. I did a $200,000 indie movie called Frankie and Johnny Are Married, about an experience that I had directing a play with my wife. And I then wrote a script about the experience, and I starred in the movie, wrote it, and directed it. And we got great reactions, great response, some great reviews. It was distributed. It was actually played in a couple of theaters, and it's on Amazon. And
it's available on Amazon.
Yep. And
watching now for $2.99.
Yep, $2.99. Yeah, I think I see a penny. But I want to do it again. I think that the television world is, and I was saying it to this young woman today. I said, this is a school, this is an education, this is going to the gym, and it's making a living so that you can continue with, the real work that means something to you personally. This is a different kind of work. And I will say that I've done work that I'm very, very proud of in television. I have no shame about it at all. But
yeah, you won an Emmy for Best TV Show.
Right. And I don't want to keep doing episodes the rest of my life.
Yeah, I don't know. It's, I guess, just to play devil's advocate here a little bit. I mean, you talk about the highs and lows, but based on your IMDb, which I'm sure is just a tiny fraction of the work you've actually done, doesn't include the scripts you've written, the
right.
meetings you've had, the shows, the pilots you shot that didn't get picked up.
Right.
Like, since 1976, the only year you don't have a credit is 1981, right?
Yeah.
So you've pretty much been just, like, working nonstop, and I have never really directed episodic TV. Oh. I've done an indie feature. I did a TV movie, wow. like movie of the week. And I did, I've done a bunch of commercials and other things. And I find it myself hard to be like, I can't go back and make a $200,000 movie. That's like a giant step back. But then you see someone like you who's won the Emmy, directed 50 episodes of TV at this point, and then still goes and writes and directs and stars in a $200,000 movie. Like, what's your secret for that motivation?
Well,
I guess is my question.
Okay. What I have been able to let go of, or trying to let go of, I don't think I've succeeded completely, and because you're in the same time that you're working in an art form, you've got another eye on distribution, exposure, reaching an audience, being acknowledged, being successful, and becoming a star. Okay, let's face it. You know, you're always sitting there secretly, privately going, maybe this movie's going to go out and it's like everyone's going to talk about it and see it, and it's going to make, you know, $50 million, and I made it for $4 million, and it'll be, you know, my door will be they'll be banging down my door, and I'll get nominated for an Oscar. And, you know, who doesn't have those fantasies? Come on. But the key is to learn to, and I am still learning to at the age of 68, to control those fantasies and not let them control you. So that if I look at the landscape and I go, look, the thing that is most intriguing to me, that is most challenging and rewarding, is the personal statement, the thing that I want to say, that I want to write and I want to direct and tell a dramatic or a humorous story, and hopefully people will discover it. I just finished directing a play in 99-seat theater in Los Angeles, and we have gotten incredible reviews, and there have been articles written about the play. It's all about the Blacklist, and that's another whole subject. And maybe as I'm talking, it does relate to what we're talking about, because my father was blacklisted in the whole 50s McCarthy period, the Red Scare.
He was a screenwriter?
He was an actor and became a director. He was also a director in the theater and an acting teacher, and was directing in the original live television before the heyday, which was in the 50s. He was in 1947 directing 1 hour and a half hour dramas that were not even recorded because they were live. I mean, they've never been videotaped. I found a couple of kinescopes of his work, but it basically has gone and disappeared. And specifically, because it's really an interesting story, he was an original member of the Actors Studio, which was formed in 1947. And the Actors Studio started a live half-hour TV series. And my father directed the second episode, and he proceeded to become the director of that series, rotating with Martin Ritt and Daniel Mann, and these were colleagues of his. And they each did an episode, rotated three directors. And his career rose, and in 1952, he was blacklisted because he was a card-carrying member of the Communist Party in the 1930s. And he was a very political person and believed in things as shocking as voting rights for black people and Social Security and unions. And you'd call him a centrist, a Democrat today. But, you know, it was right at the time of the Depression and socialized, you know, the WPA and so many things that Roosevelt did that, you know, started bringing the country back on its feet. So that's where the Communist Party and the lefties and the whole artistic scene went, especially in New York. Anyway, he didn't work for 15 years in television and went back to teaching, and in his 60s started working again. And by the time he was 70, he got a soap opera that was handed. There was no work in New York, and he had known live cameras. And my father worked to the age of 85, and he was had such a spirit about him that he bounced back in such a way that I think it was a great role model for me to see, you know, to be the gratitude and not the bitterness is the point. So,
yeah,
you know,
wow.
I mean, I'm a very lucky guy, and I've worked really hard, and I've studied, and I keep learning. And, you know, this play, which is called Sphinx, and it's about people who named names and people who didn't. And the play is going to run to the end of December, and maybe it'll be seen by 3,000 or 4,000 people.
Where is it playing?
At the Electric Lodge Theater in Venice, California, with the Rogue Machine Theater Company. And you just go online, you type in Sphinx or Rogue Machine, which is the name of the theater company, and it'll lead you to the Electric Lodge, which is 1416 Electric Avenue in Venice, 90291. And it plays on weekends. And we're getting great response, and it's been a totally thrilling, exhilarating experience.
That's awesome. I've kind of fantasized about directing live theater. My mom is actually a theater director and producer.
What's her name?
She does like community theaters community theater in Pasadena area. And I was like, I wonder if I should try directing one of her plays. Because I've never directed like a play, but it seems like you get to really focus on, you know,
the blocking
and the performances.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, there's no camera. Right?
And there's no camera. Are you guys in LA? You are, huh?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, you know, I've been getting incredible reactions from the play, and it was an exhilarating experience. It'd be interesting. And my answer to your subtle question is, absolutely direct a play and fall on your face if you do, because the stakes are low. And I actually thought, well, maybe this will work, maybe it won't work, you know, and turned out it did. But you never know. You never know. Well,
Michael, I think that's really interesting advice. Let me ask, how would someone go about doing that? Basically, like, because, you know, Los Angeles is kind of like it's a competitive, but it's still a robust theater town, actually. There's more theater going on than people realize.
Totally.
It's just that people aren't talking about it. How did you get involved with Sphinx?
You know what? I through different circumstances, this particular one, my wife, Maya Danzinger, great, great, wonderful woman who was an actress when she was young, and now she's a writer and teaches writing, was an original member of this theater company. And so she introduced me to them, and I presented the play. But here's the bottom line. First of all, anybody who's interested in the theater, I think, has to take an acting class. I've taken acting classes at the high point of my career after Dr. Detroit. I studied for 2 years with a famous acting teacher named Bobby Lewis, who was from the group theater in the 30s. And he was in L.A. teaching, and I saw an ad, and I picked up called his number, and I was interviewed, and I took his class, and I acted in scenes. And then when I was in New York 5 years ago, I was 6 months, I didn't have anything to do, and I took a class from William Esper, who's another great acting teacher in New York. And what was really wild was I was in this class, and I was acting in scenes, and I got a phone call. A director fell out for an episode of Justified, which is a great series, absolutely great series. And I was like, oh my God. And they said, are you free in 2 weeks to come out and direct an episode of Justified, season 5? And I jumped at it, and I found out when I told the people at Esper that I was leaving the class, they said, Justified, Timothy Oliphant, a student of Bill. So I go out there, and, you know, he doesn't know me from Adam, and he's the star of the show, and he's also the producer, and he's basically a very, very, he's not tough. He's a sweetheart, but he's the main guy. And I went on the set, and I said, and they weren't hiring new directors. They couldn't find anybody. So I was the last choice. So he didn't know me. And I go up to Tim, and I go, by the way, I'm here. I'll be doing the next episode. He goes, oh, great. I said, I have regards to you from Bill Esper. I just finished taking his class. And he melted. Bill? You took Bill's class? I said, yeah, I was acting for six. Are you kidding? He was like, and then he became a different person. And we had the greatest time doing this episode. And then I came back for the penultimate episode the next season, and I saw him in a play. And it was like, you know, the relationship, and I'm going to digress to one other point. If there's anything that's more important than, there's nothing more important than the relationship between the actor and the director, whether it's a play or a television episode or your own movie, it's your relationships with the actors. That's the single most important thing. And, you know,
So what's your strategy to, especially when you're doing TV and you are probably not getting a lot of time with these actors ahead of time, and also it's more their show than your show, how do you quickly like form a bond or like get them to trust you? What are kind of some of the,
well,
what's your method?
Well, I first assume, depending on how long the show has been on, we'll talk about Mariska Hargitay, who I've been working with for the last several years and whom I love to death. She's now in her 20th year. She knows her character. I'm not going to tell her about her character, but right. She is open to direction. So when I say, we had a moment that was one of my favorite moments. She had a big scene, 3-minute scene where she was very emotional, and it was all about she was on trial for some event where someone accused her of abusing her own child. And she was enraged and upset, and she was emotional, and she did this take, and she finished, and she said, that was great. And she looked at me, and I said, well, and she said, oh, give me a break. You're not going to ask me to do it again, are you? And I went, yeah. She said, what the fuck? What do you want? And I said, you didn't come here to play this scene. And she stopped and went, I get it. Okay. Because she had just, like, she was so spent when she did it again. It was so genuine and so real that afterwards she just literally hugged me and said, thank you, thank you. So,
right. She gave it her all, but it felt like she was giving it her all.
Correct. So what is the, what's the key? And here's the key. And this is sort of after 20 years of studying acting and doing the job. You as a director are the truth barometer. You're the one who has to watch and go, I believe it. I get it, or guess what? There's a little too much acting here, or there's not enough here, or what's the subject? What are the stakes? You're not working on character in episodes, and when you're doing a movie, you are, and that's another whole story. But when you're coming in as a guest director, you're guiding the performance, and actors love to be directed the right way. They don't want to be told, you move here, you move there, make it louder, make it softer. Unless some of them do. I mean, Raul Esparza, whom I love too, working on Long Nights for You, was always like, before I'd open my mouth, he'd say, it was terrible, right? And I'd say, no, but let's do it again. He said, I know. I was shit. Okay, watch. I'll do it again. And that was his language. And, right. and then I'll never forget my first day on an episode of Alpha House. John Goodman's doing a monologue to a Senate hearing. And it's the first thing up in the morning, and he does it, and he's fine. And he doesn't know me from Adam, but I go up to him, and I said, let's just do it one more. He said, what do you want? I said, just a little slower. And he went, no one's told me ever to go slower. I said, well, yeah, just go a little slower. And he did, and he said, yep, better, thank you. And that was it, you know. But so you gain trust in the subtlest of ways, and that's the process. How do I gain the trust? You got to be brave. You got to be honest. You can also not say anything, you know, if it doesn't, you know, you don't jump into the deep water, get your toes wet, but know who your actors are and find out that, know that they all like to get feedback, positive feedback.
Right. Well, let me ask you a question that might seem kind of dumb.
Okay, no, but, none of these questions are dumb.
About directing performance.
Wait, Michael.
Okay, all right, let me hear it.
Because obviously you have so much experience working with so many actors, but like when you say something to the effect of, that you're the truth barometer, that you see, oh, that felt like acting and I want it to not feel like acting. I mean, that's like every other performance, every other set I'm on, I have that problem. Like that, I don't believe it. You know, I feel like you're saying the words in the script, but do you arm yourself with, here's like things I can say to like go slower, or you didn't come here for this speech. Like, is that just something that is coming out of your instinct because you've done it so much? Or do you have like a list of words that you know work well and are actionable?
I don't have a list of words. I have found it through trial and error. You cannot ask yourself to be the kind of director you are on your first or your second experience that you will be on your 15th experience. It just takes time. But I have sat there and been very frustrated and been unable to change a performance. It happens. I have to back up and say, if you're talking about your own movie, there's one thing that's singly the most important thing about directing, and that is casting. I will never forget, I met Martin Ritt, famous director, who was a colleague of my father's, and I met him when I was at film school, and I asked him about directing, and he said, cast well, you'll direct well. In essence, when you cast, you've got to believe the actor in the audition. And, or if you're casting off of film or whatever, you really got to see this person can do this role. Life will be so much easier, but if you're casting somebody who isn't right, that's a very tough problem already. You've given yourself an obstacle. It's all in the casting. It's all in the casting. That's for starters. Then the next thing is to help the actor listen to the other actor in the scene. It's always very important where you start to feel like, well, they're not really listening, but hear what they have to say. And if they really need the help, it's kind of like, you know, take your time. Take your time. Let's not worry about pace right now. These are things I will say. I'll also ask people to read it with as little emotion as possible first time around to get a feel for it. And then we'll start to block it. And I'll say, if it's sitting there and I feel like I need movement, I might go, how do you feel about getting up and going over to the window? And the person goes, why? And I say, well, what this person just said was so upsetting. I don't want to look at this person. I give a reason. I will never say, well, I need it for the camera. I will never go, you know, please do it for my...
That's fun.
You know, even though you do need it for the camera sometimes.
when you really get to know the actors and look, you're on a series and it's very experienced, there have been times when I'm going, you know, if you guys want to get out of here in an hour and I do this in one shot, how about you moving over there? And they go, yes, we'll do it. Boom. What do you wear?
Sure,
you know,
right.
We'll make it work, you know, and if we can, we do. So everyone
right. Well, if you've been on a show for 20 years, you kind of, it's okay for a director to say, well, we need this for the camera, right?
Yeah.
I think, the more time an actor logs on a show over day in and day out, the more camera savvy they become, right? Like,
I mean,
they're directing a lot of episodes themselves even.
Right,
you know?
But let me tell you, and you know, Johnny Lee Miller on Elementary is very difficult to direct and stage, but I'll tell you why. And I have empathy for him, and I figured it out very early and realized I really can't talk to him and stage him. It's frustrating, but they hand him of an 8-page day or a 7-page day, 6 pages is his dialogue. And he has spent the whole night and the early morning learning every word so he can come in and speak like Sherlock Holmes, you know, going a mile a minute. And he can't focus on anything else than getting those damn words out and acting. But he, you know, ask him to start moving and get a coffee cup and blah, blah, blah. He's like, no, I'm going to stand right here and I'm going to say it. He's figured out a way to get through the day. And I get it. I get it. I have empathy for it. It's frustrating as a director, I will tell you. You know, you're not going to get an opportunity to direct him and you can't take it personally.
I think it's fascinating to think about how each show, and you've done so many of them, but each show has its own set of quirks and challenges and like pressures that they put on the performers, whether that's page count or a ton of dialogue or action or, you know, jargon, right? Like there's a lot of, you know, procedurals are filled with like jargon, right? Yep. Like you're doing doctor jargon, you're doing like forensic jargon, all of that stuff, right?
Yep.
So let me ask, Michael, before we wrap it up, just kind of going to the basics of, you know, you were talking about casting. What are the other things that you do before you land on set? What's your prep like?
Very interesting. Now, in any way, I mean, film, episode, try to give the general.
I think actually more specifically, I'm curious about the way that you prep an episode of TV, right. Maybe even specifically the stuff that leans more procedural,
right.
You know, because there's so much of a regimented style to that. And Oren, hop in, help me out.
Yeah, I watch a lot of Law and Order. My wife has an improv team that does an improvised episode of Law and Order once a month at the UCB theater.
I'd love to see it.
And you know, they've
Michael, you should come. Okay, that would be great. Yeah,
they've nailed the format. Unfortunately, they only do the law part, but they want to. It's like a 20-minute set of the law.
It's a comedy,
but
right?
They're hoping
a comedy,
to
right or is it or serious.
Yeah, it's 100% improvised. Okay. Like the audience gives the name of the episode, and then they always open up with somebody is at work. They find a dead body, then they find some clues at that body that lead them to like four different locations. They go to each location, interview the people there. Then there's an autopsy scene, which kind of gives away which of the people at the locations did it, and then they catch them.
It sounds hysterical. I'll be in LA in February. Unfortunately, I won't be back until then, but. You'll send me the information so I can go. It sounds like fun.
For sure. Yeah, but even the improv version of Law and Order is so regimented, like, you know, we all know Law and Order is kind of these ripped from the headlines
right.
stories. I know you did an episode about children being separated from their parents. Recently. What are just the steps, you know? You could just take us through the days before you get to set.
Okay, well, I always, when I read the script, the very first time I get a script, I read it without interruption, quietly, as a viewer. I consciously read it as a viewer watching the episode. I do not think about my directing. I do not think about the acting.
You don't make any notes or anything?
No notes. I read it to capture the emotional line of where the story is and where my head is. And then I'll read it again and still take no notes, but start to absorb the inner life of the script and what it's about. You know, that particular episode you're talking about was clear. It was a morality tale. And the anguish and the pain that everyone felt in relation to the separating of this little girl from her mother and how they all became invested in bringing them back together. That's at the heart of it. And I have to digress and say for one thing, I had an experience once when I was 25 directing a sequel to The Bad News Bears. I lost my script with all my notes in it in prep. And then I found it.
Yeah. How soon before the shoot?
It was about 3 weeks before the shoot, and the script had been left at a location, and I freaked out. And we went back to that location, and I found the script. And after that, I went, I am never taking notes on a piece of paper that if I lose the piece of paper, I don't know what I'm doing. I memorize all my notes. I learn my lines. I look at the script. I look at the scenes. I think about it. I think about it. I become very absorbed. I become like an actor. I learn the story. I that's what I do. I become very totally into the material, to the way in which I learn the backstories and I learn the circumstances, and I become as knowledgeable about the story as a writer, maybe even more so, in the sense that I ask questions that they never even considered. And I show up for the very first meeting with a real understanding, and then with some very fundamental questions about things that either don't make sense or maybe I can help make sense in the script, in the directing. That's where I begin. Now, there's a whole procedure that's pretty standard on most shows, which is there's a casting session, there's scouting locations, meetings with props and set dressing and wardrobe and all this stuff. And those, I keep going back to understanding what the script is, you know, and understanding where the characters are. So I work very internally and organically. I don't make a shot list. I don't.
Yeah, man.
Yep. I do know.
Wait, for TV, you don't make a shot list?
No. I do know. I do know pretty roughly how I'm going to stage something, and I work out shots in my head, and I'll go to the location, and I'll figure out where people move. But it could change on a dime. You know, also an actor has an idea, you know, it's completely different, and I'll think it's, you know, if it's working, I'll go with it, and I'll let it take me wherever it takes me. But I know what the story is, and I know what needs to be told. So if what the actor's doing has nothing to do with the story, I'll stop them.
I love that so much, and you know, Michael, I have kind of a mixed opinion of shot lists myself. Sometimes yeah. I like to kind of do your method, and some other times I think I get a little more
complete
technical.
Complete
I think.
Shot list for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles to the point where it was storyboarded every shot. Because I had so many issues. I had puppets, I had
right.
creatures, I had stunts, I had, you know, where's the camera going to be in relation to where the puppeteers are going to be, and, you know,
sure.
that stuff
yeah.
you have to do.
Yeah.
But
let me ask, though on your current projects, how does your crew feel about you not shotlisting? How does the AD, just kind of go by page count? Like, how does your DP interact? Like, what is that conversation like?
I have to say that when I first start on a new show, I know that I can honestly say, even though I have a reputation and they, you know, they know I work quickly and I come in on time and I actually stage quickly, no one really knows until they work with me. So I've always seen and sort of laughed at the idea that I can tell people are very anxious before I begin because they've asked me, you know, so what's your shot? And I go, well, I don't know yet. And it's like, I'll say, but if you really want to know, we can. And then if I get like the producer kind of the panic look, I'll say, well, we'll start over here. And I think when the person walks in, I'll move over there and da da da. You know, to ease them, not for me, to ease people. Because when all of a sudden I'm staging it and looking at it with the camera, and it might change completely. But I really have worked it out in my head. You know, Mariska Hargitay makes a big joke about, you know, she says to me when she's directing, and she's done now about 5 episodes, is that she's loved to come in and, as she says, do a pressman. I did a pressman because she, you know, staged it and came up with the ideas of how to shoot it right on the spot, and it came out quickly, and all of a sudden people were moving and it had a flow, and she saw it and found it and, you know, trusted that she could fly. And that's what I like to do. It's kind of like flying. It is skydiving without a net. And it's scary at first, but once you start to do it and succeed and start to realize, you know, how terrific your work can be, it's exhilarating. And I'll close with this story, and this is where this comes from. I was doing Boulevard Nights, which was a movie about East Los Angeles Chicano gangs, and the cameraman was John Bailey, brilliant cameraman who has done, you know, 30, 40 wonderful movies. And he and I was 27, he was a couple years older. It was his first film in the feature, it was my third feature. And we worked out every shot. We didn't storyboard, but we talked through the script and worked out every shot. And we got to a location, and it was a funeral, and it was a 2-page scene after the funeral when the gang members are getting into their cars, and there's several moments. And the production manager came and said, we're being kicked out of a parking lot and the cemetery. We've lost the permit, and they're kicking us out, and you've got 45 minutes. And I went, what? And I turned to John, I said, what do we do? And he went, well, I'll lay 40 feet of track. You stage from the track. I'll get the camera on the dolly. You place the cars. Let's see if we can get it. We killed ourselves in a half hour, pulled it all together. I said to the second, the AD, work the background. I'll work with the principals. We were like wildfire. We got it. The next day in the screening room, that's how we used to look at dailies, I'm watching the footage and I go, why is this the best shot of the movie? I didn't even know what we were doing. Why is this so sort of improvisational and thrilling? And it was all of a sudden, it was a clue. And it was like, it was the light bulb that went off for me that whenever I really allowed the opportunity to play and improvise and create, it would show up on the screen. And I will also close with this line. if you're making a movie, you're working in oils and you're painting in the foreground, the background. When you're doing a television movie or a pilot, it's a watercolor. But when you're doing a television episode, it's a pencil drawing. And there is an art to a pencil drawing. And you got to work fast, you got to work intuitively, and you've got to make time your friend, not your enemy. Because if you're struggling with, I don't have enough time, I don't have enough time, flip it. I have to create within this time, and that's exciting, and that's a challenge. What fun.
Sage advice, Michael. That's pretty great, man. So good.
Go out there and do it. You can do it.
Just shoot it.
Just shoot it. You got it. It's the story of your podcast.
Exactly right. Well, Michael, would you stick around with us? We'd love to talk a little bit more, but we got to get into our endorsements.
All right, the endorsement. You got one, because one's been sitting in the back of my mind, and it's utterly unrelated to everything, right?
Ooh, great. Well, mine's real dumb, so okay. Michael, take it away.
Unpaid endorsements.
Margaret's Lobster Rolls. Margaret's Lobster Rolls in Northport, Maine. She has a little stand off Route 1 between Camden and Belfast and makes by far the best lobster rolls in Maine, if not in the whole country.
Whoa, look out.
She has already been written up. She's got a little stand. She just opened about 3 years ago. Every time I take anybody to this little stand to have a lobster roll at Margaret's, it's like she won't even take the lobster from the Penobscot Bay. She ships it from up north on the border of Canada because the lobster is tastier. And and I'm telling you, whatever she uses, a particular kind of butter, gives her mayonnaise, and you've never had anything like it. And it's one of the reasons I love Maine is Margaret's Lobster Roll.
Wow. I've never been to Maine.
Oh.
And I don't eat lobster.
Oh.
But
all right.
But it sounds amazing.
Yeah, take a look at pictures. But more than that, Maine. Oh, I've been going to Maine for 30 years, and I sail, and I have a sailboat, and I love Maine. That is where I
That's
recharge.
Awesome. Do you ever see Stephen King?
No, I don't. he's well, Bangor, Maine. I'm more by the water, but I love Stephen King. I'd love to meet him. And if he ever listens to
yeah.
me, I would bet he's going to drive on down to try out Margaret's Lobster Roll. And if
we have gotten a lot of interesting questions from Stephen Kay from Maine. So,
well, I'm telling you, reach out to him and just say, we just got an endorsement for Margaret's Lobster Roll. Have you heard of him?
No.
I don't think he does, but he'll go down and try them. And he won't be disappointed.
Sounds like it. Margaret's Lobster Roll. Yep. Sounds great, man.
All right.
Oren, you got anything?
I'll let you go first.
Okay, well, mine, like I said, mine's real dumb. So have either of you two seen Game Night or Widows?
Oh, yes, I saw Widows.
I want to see Widows. I have not seen Widows. I have not seen Game Night. What's
it? It's a backdoor endorsement of both Game Night and Widows, and I think actually maybe one other movie that I haven't seen. I think Insidious. But the little white dog in Widows and Game Night, its real name is Olivia, it's a Westie, is incredible.
Really?
It's the cutest dog in the world, and both of those movies are pretty great. Widows, I really love. Widows is like maybe my favorite movie of the year.
Wow.
Game Night is very
That's
good.
The one I want to see. I'll go see it this weekend. Or,
oh man, yeah. So good. Every choice in Widows, I think, is really awesome. The directing is impeccable. The cast is awesome. Like I loved everything about it, especially that little white dog.
Well, we have a little white dog of our own, and we want to figure out how to get him work, and maybe this will be an inspiration.
Listen, man, it is a masterclass. But, and I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek here, but I do genuinely love when animals are used in movies in a really organic and naturalistic sort of way. So, like, this dog doesn't really do a ton.
It's mostly not like just the artist.
Yeah, no, it's not. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Talk about a ham.
Yeah, I know, that's a little ham. That's funny.
But you know, I love, it's like, there's something so human about having an animal in the space, and it says so much about the character. And, you know, a dog can't help but improvise most of the time. You know, they're just kind of sitting around in the scene.
Yeah.
And if you block and shoot it right, I think it can really add an incredible additional layer to your filmmaking.
I completely agree. This is great. I'm looking forward to it. I know there's more in this movie than just the dog, so I know I'm...
Well, I won't spoil anything else.
All right.
But there is a dog in the movie.
Well, did we already talk about Homecoming? Speaking of kind of impeccable choices.
Oh, I don't think so, actually.
Homecoming.
No. Well, Homecoming, it's on Amazon. It's based on a podcast. So Homecoming is a TV show, and I think it might be a miniseries.
Yeah, it is.
It stars Julia Roberts.
Oh, yeah, sure. Has it started to air?
Directed by... Yeah, it's on... You can watch every episode on Amazon Prime.
Okay.
Directed by Sam Esmail of Mr. Robot.
Wow, he's amazing.
Like, the best set you've ever seen, because it doesn't feel like a set. And but the camera is doing all these totally impossible things that I think in the hands of maybe someone else you'd think are like overly flashy or distracting, but here they just like create this tone and a mood that I just really loved. And the story is so interesting, and it's definitely the first TV show I've seen that's been adapted from pretty much a radio play, aka a podcast. I really love that. That's one of my endorsements. The other thing is this thing I just realized today, which is like totally geeky and has nothing to do with anything we've talked about.
Okay.
But on Chrome,
yeah,
which Michael just installed today,
yep,
just for us, Google Chrome, if you go to the menus and go to more tools, so there's these like three vertical dots at the top right of your screen.
Mm-hmm.
If you click on that and you go to more tools, you can go to developer tools mode. And when you're in that mode, there's this icon that lets you view whatever web page you're on as if you're looking at it on an iPhone or an iPad. You can choose any device you want.
Wow.
So this lets you kind of do a lot of interesting things. First of all, if you're writing a pitch or a treatment or trying to show, like Photoshop a phone screen into someone's hand, you could actually like do it on your computer and get that phone screen out of Chrome.
Wow.
There's some apps like Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
That you can only upload photos to Instagram from your phone. But if you use Google Chrome and your desktop and you use this developer tools and tell your browser to tell Instagram.com that you're accessing it through a phone, it'll let you do all the things that you can do on your phone, but from your computer. So you can start dragging images that you've edited and doing all these things that I've always taken so many extra steps. Well, awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming and talking to us and your wealth of knowledge. I hope, you know, we can have you back in the future, because I feel like we just kind of scratched the surface.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I'm glad we finally did this, and I would definitely do it again.
Okay, well, if people want to find out about your play, Finks, F-I-N-K-S,
yes,
it's playing in Venice.
Yep, Venice, California, and just type in Finks, and it'll send you to either the Rogue Machine Theater Company, or just the Electric Lodge, or you type in LA Times, Finks, it'll bring up some of the articles and the interviews and all that stuff.
Awesome.
All right.
Well, cool. Well, if you guys want to write any questions for us, comments, anything you want to tell us, you can email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can also find us on all social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We're at justshootitpod. I'm on Twitter as @SmiteyPyleg.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow. This episode was edited by Christopher Robert Gray. Our producer is Madeline Rose Watt. And our webmaster is Ewan Williams. The music you're listening to right now is by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Thanks so much, everyone.
Bye. Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.